Succession number 4431, reel number 3.
Mr. Wallach, tape 3. Could you describe Camp L, please, Mr. Wallach, and tell us what sort of accommodation you had there, first of all?
It was a hutted camp on the Heights of Abraham, where Wolfe and Montcalm fought their battle for the control of Canada by the British or the French, therefore a very historic site. Decent army barrack huts, newly built clearly, surrounded by barbed wire, with adequate, if not luxurious, hygienic facilities, good kitchen facilities, several broad streets, you might almost call them, going through it. But the problem, basically, that we were confined to it. We were eating well, we were doing no work, we were doing what studies we could, taking in, as I said before, each other's intellectual washing, but it was now quite clear that this internment was no temporary matter of today or tomorrow we will be released. We were now in Canada, and we were all settling down to a routine. We administered ourselves, that is to say, we ran a camp office under the camp leader. We ran our kitchen and our cooking. We ran what recreation there was. There were Canadian soldiers and non-commissioned officers inside the compound supervising us, but leaving us largely to our own devices. There was a time to get up. This was fixed. I think it was 7:30 or 8 o'clock. Beyond that, and the time of lights out, which was 10 o'clock at night, there were no rules or regulations laid down. We were looking, to that extent, after ourselves. Now, the camp leadership had always been one of the bones of contention in each camp, and there were many candidates for it. We were now in a very different ball game from what we had been in England, where the university groups had been in a minority. Here, because of the selection process in the Isle of Man, and because of the way in which the groups had amalgamated and coalesced, we were a much more homogeneous society of largely university people, youngish people. There were a few older people, but very few who would come in by accident, as it were. And the camp leadership went almost by default to Count Lingen. Previously, he had been regarded as something of an embarrassment, compromising almost. Here, he had certain advantages, which transpired before long. Though he was traveling incognito, it became clear even to our camp commandant and his officers that he was a little more than just a plain German nobleman. This was very soon made even clearer by a letter he sent to the wife of the then Governor General of Canada, the Earl of Athlone, headed "Dear Auntie Alice," and which was smartly returned to him by the camp intelligence officer. "What on earth do you think you're doing?" He then explained that the Countess Alice of Athlone was his godmother, that he had a perfect right to write to her. He had written saying that what really we needed was recreational equipment, which we had very little of. His letter went through. An aide of the Governor General appeared in the camp in due course, brought with him various things like footballs and baseball bats and I think there was high-jumping equipment as well. The response impressed the camp commandant, who felt that he was in the presence here of high society. In fact, he got Prince Frederick frequently to come and entertain his parties with the accordion, which Fitz played very well as an amateur, and liked pointing out to his guests, "You're being entertained by a member of the Imperial House of Germany." So there were many advantages to having Prince Frederick as a camp leader, cynically perhaps, but we made use of that, and he was perfectly happy to play the role. He was, as to the manner born, he was a stickler for punctuality, for neatness in dress, for hygiene, withal reasonably diplomatic in his behavior, and had the support of a group of young men who might well in other circumstances have been described as a court, although they themselves would have run a mile before admitting this. The main administrative man in the office under him, I suppose, was Hans Frankel, an engineering student from Cambridge. Anthony Michaelis, Hans-Peter Binswanger, Max Löwenthal, a man called Novak, a rather sort of sinister figure in an amusing way. Nobody knew his background. He was older than the rest of us. He was legally trained, and he seemed to have an air of intrigue about him. I don't know what has happened to him. Slightly further removed, but still very much within the ambit of this university intellectual crowd, were the group of lawyers, which was Conrad Goldschmidt, now Mr. Brian Grant, Mr. Justice Brian Grant, Hans Wilmersdorfer, who is now Mr. John Wilmers, QC, and Michael Carr, also a QC, I believe, now son of the eminent German literary historian, and Charles Retter, who later on became a producer in the BBC. Again, a little further out on the fringes, the scientists, which was Friedländer and Fuchs and one or two others, Bondi very much in that crowd, all doing their own thing, sticking to groups of intellectual interests, living on the whole fairly harmoniously, and expecting to live like that for a long time.
How practical were they, I wonder, these intellectual men?
Not particularly practical. No. We had a large number of other young men there too who were not in any way connected with universities, many of them Austrians, who were hoping to go to Israel. These were strongly Orthodox, or at least believing Jews, and they were the ones who, on the whole, did the practical work, who did the cooking. Everybody did the serving at meals, but the cooking, the hairdressing, the general chores of a community of this kind. I'm afraid in that part of the enterprise, the university undergraduates and graduates played a very much less prominent part. They talked a good deal, and they worked a fair amount on their own enterprises, but practically they were not very effective, and this was, as I say, done by others, much of it under the authority and with the guidance of Hans Kahle, who was always, in a way, a counterpoise to Frederick, two men of considerable eminence in their own right, the one by inheritance and the other one by his own achievements, and both of them playing a major role in camp. But the basic attitude you must now think of as one of knowing that we were there for some considerable time, a great deal of activity of writing to members of Parliament in England, trying to present our case, seeing what we could do to get returned to Britain, to get released in one way or another, and a great deal of hard work went into that. Whether any of it was effective, I cannot tell, but gradually, as British papers percolated to us, we saw that our cases were being discussed in the Commons, that, in fact, release was gradually being organized. It became evident that many people in Britain thought that the internment and certainly the dispersal of the internees had been precipitate and perhaps not well thought out, that many of them ought to be returned. There were stories that eminent men who were needed for war work were not available for war work, and gradually it evolved that there were going to be a number of groups of people who could be repatriated on one ground or another. There were, first of all, war effort requirements. That was the most important, obviously. Scientific distinction or academic distinction was another one. A desire to serve in the armed forces was a third, which embraced anybody. Anybody who wished to join the armed forces would become eligible for release. This all began to transpire in the late summer and early autumn to us in Camp L, and we all awaited a verdict on this in our individual cases, that it would come soon. Into this burst the news that we were all going to be transferred again, or some of us were going to be transferred again. Camp L was in fact extremely comfortable, insofar as internment ever is comfortable. We had all lived ourselves in there. Now to be told that we were going to be split up again caused considerable annoyance, fear, worry as to how we would be split up, on what grounds. As the lists were prepared in our camp office, but on the instructions of the camp commandant and his intelligence officer, it appeared as if those who were to go were going to be the confessional Jews and the Aryans left behind. This caused paranoia, and immediately Prince Frederick volunteered to join the Jewish group and be removed to another camp, so that if they were trying to make a distinction of this kind, such a move by the Hohenzollern would make that pretty ineffective if they allowed it. Well, we were allowed to amend the lists to a certain extent. Those who were volunteering to go were allowed to volunteer in certain cases. In fact, it became perfectly evident, had we only been able to see it sensibly and impartially, that nobody was making any lists from any preconceived point of view, but that for reasons best known to themselves, the Canadians wanted to shift part of this camp to another camp which they were building. This was Camp N, which was on the railway, the main railway line between Quebec and Montreal. We travelled there by train. We came to a large railway repair shed, which was that and nothing else. The weather was still reasonable, but turning cool and cold. There were no lavatory facilities except outdoor, beginning to freeze a little, uncomfortable. Many complaints that these sheds were totally inadequate. They certainly weren't as nice as our hutted camp was. But before long, in fact, the Canadians brought in their carpenters, and in no time at all they fitted up huts for our kitchens, for our lavatories, for our shower rooms, and so on. Marvelously efficient, with axes, working hardly at all with saws. It seemed all to be done by axe, and the axe blows were accurate to fractions of an inch as far as we could see. We were all very much impressed by them in the typical Canadian lumber jackets, and they put up the necessary facilities so that in the end Camp N became extremely comfortable, and of course it was extremely warm because the railway repair shed was a network of hot air piping, so it was in fact very cozy and warm. It was from there, it was there that we found again a man whom we'd lost in Camp L, a man called Arnold of the very prestigious German firm of Arnold and Bleichröder. He had, when he came to Canada, had a visa to the United States. However, under American law, and I think this was a law enacted because of the wetback invasion from Mexico, you could not at that time, and I don't know whether it has changed, you could not, without special permission, enter as an immigrant into the United States from an adjacent country. So his visa, which had been perfectly valid from England, which was after all not an adjacent country, became invalid from Canada. His family, who had considerable influence and enough wealth to engage good lawyers, got him a temporary visa to Cuba, from where he would be able to immigrate to the United States, again not an adjacent country because there was a sea in between. So one day he left in high hopes of getting to America from our camp L, and we received him, to our considerable surprise, back in Camp N several months later. His odyssey was this. He had been sent away with two soldiers escorting him to Montreal, or wherever he was going to go from on his journey to Cuba, and having reached an intermediate destination, they got off the train and were going to have a meal, and Arnold, not unreasonably, said, "Look, I don't like very much the idea of going into a restaurant in a pair of red striped trousers and a red circle on the back of my shirt or jacket, and escorted by two soldiers with rifles."
Was that the uniform you all wore?
That was the uniform we all wore. We wore denims, first time I've ever worn denims, and they had broad red stripes down their sides and a jacket with a red circle on the back. So the soldiers could see his point, and they said, "Well, look, there is in fact an internment camp quite close by. We'll pop in there and have a meal there, and then go on." Well, they did that. Then turned out that although Arnold had a permission to go to Cuba, he had no permission to leave a camp except Camp L. So he stayed in this other camp, suddenly back to square one, as it were, and when his visa to Cuba had expired, it was only a temporary visa, back he was shipped to Camp N. He got out later, but it was an extraordinary tale of misadventure. Anyway, Camp N was also to us suspect because we had all been hoping for possible release from Camp L, and now feared that with this move, all this would once again be pushed into the background. There would be further administrative confusion. Nobody would know where we were. And our papers, which had all been applications for release from internment, which had all been sent off from Camp L, would never be returned to us at Camp M, or they wouldn't be found. We wouldn't be found. A great deal of reluctance about going, but we went. And in fact, Camp M turned out quite comfortable. And then one day, was it in November? I forget, but it was already in very cold weather. It may indeed have been December. Yes, it must have been December of 1940. There appeared Her Majesty's Commissioner for Prisons, Alexander Patterson. We heard 2 days before he came that he was coming, and I was very much startled because I knew him well and had known him for many years. And wondered what he was up to and why he should come. Well, he asked to see me on his arrival. It was typical of him that he should appear at Camp M in sub-zero temperatures, dressed in a pair of pinstripe trousers, a black jacket, a butterfly collar, and a Homburg hat, and no overcoat. And we had a long talk in the boiler room of Camp N, which was the only private place we could find, where he questioned me about what I thought of the camp and about various people about whom he wanted to know and so on. And then he had a meeting of the camp at which he said that he was authorized to arrange the return of a certain number of people whose names he had on the various grounds of release that were available, and in fact some 160 people 10 days or a fortnight later embarked on a train and went to Halifax, Nova Scotia.
Were you amongst this lot?
I was amongst that lot, yes. I had a sort of toss-up in my mind whether to ask to be released on grounds of academic distinction, which was not a very valid ground, or on grounds of joining the army, and decided to join the army. I couldn't really imagine what I would do on historic research during war years in Cambridge, and that would be in any way an attractive proposition. But I was among those, and when we arrived in Halifax, we were faced with yet another piece of frustration. The captain of the ship on which we were to go told us that his crew was now interned, or a large proportion of it, and that therefore there was going to be trouble in getting the ship away. To that, you need to know the background of the ship. It was called the Tisville, and it was a Belgian Congo steamer, fairly flat-bottomed and not at all suitable for crossing the Atlantic. It had been in the port of Antwerp at the time of the German invasion of the lowlands, and had followed the call of Sir Winston Churchill and the Belgian government, which was moving rapidly into exile, to move itself out of the reach of German impounding to a British port. All this shipping assembled there was now used by the British government, whatever departments were responsible for this, for bringing in supplies to Britain. And the Tisville, which normally sailed close to the Atlantic coast through the Bay of Biscay, along the African coast and up the Congo River, now set out for the West Indies. And I don't know what load it took there, but in the West Indies it took on a load of sugar, which it was to take to Canada, and in Canada it was to load goodness knows what else, but including war material, and then sail back to Liverpool. Now, the crew, of course, could not have had less interest in the war. They were a Belgian Congo mixed crew of Lascars and Africans and Belgians, one kind or another. When they heard they were to go from Canada, where they were in comparative safety, back to Liverpool, which at that time was being very heavily bombed, they revolted and said they wouldn't do it. And so they were arrested and were now interned in irons, practically, and there was Captain Powell wishing to sail and very happy to have this lot of people to take back with him in addition to his other cargoes. But what could he do? He hadn't got a crew. Well, we were all prepared to do menial tasks on board this ship, insofar as there was any need for menial tasks. We assured him that we would look after ourselves all right. We even managed to raise a second mate, who was a Dutchman who had been interned by mistake and who had a second mate's ticket. That helped him a bit. Then there were two free Frenchmen who had travelled from Hong Kong across Canada to join De Gaulle in England. And they agitated strongly for not delaying any longer. They wanted to get back. Patterson, who was there again to supervise our embarkation, he agitated. And in the end, Powell said, OK, I've got enough of a skeleton crew, plus all you helpers. We'll sail. This time the journey, which was over Christmas, quite a good Christmas dinner, took us 21 days. We sailed in convoy. We were shadowed by a British battleship, which occasionally we could see the smoke of. We were quite clearly one of the slowest vessels in the convoy. We were obviously out to tempt U-boats because we seemed to crisscross the Atlantic, north and south and right and left and to and fro. Meanwhile, on board, we had a couple of aeroplanes. Our cargo in the hold seemed to shift, and the ship took on a considerable list, being flat-bottomed. But we made it without any incident to Liverpool. Many again seasick, but now in palatial surroundings compared with the Ettrick, because we were entirely at liberty to roam the ship. There was nobody to supervise us, no British troops or anything at all, no Canadian troops. We were free, as it were, because we were all going back to freedom.
And were you? Did you find your treatment was so different?
Totally different.
Yes.
Because and there was hardly any crew there. What crew there was engine room crew, which we hardly saw anything of. One or two of our engineers took an interest in the engine room. But for the rest, we catered for ourselves and did our own thing.